Good morning.
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 I've been thinking about samsara lately. And I was wondering whether how we thought about samsara. You know, we live in the samsara world, the so-called saha world. So do we have some idea that our world should be perfect? This is some questions that I've thought about. Do we have this perfection that we're imagining is some kind of harmony that we're all engaged in, some kind of kindness that we all agree upon? Do we think that the teachings of Buddha nature and interconnectedness means somehow that everybody's going to be on board with this idea that we have of how the world should be? So, if these things are not true, does this mean that Buddhism fails us? Does it mean that Buddhism can't address the problems of the world? So, what is it about this world? How do we reconcile our ideas about what the world should be and how it actually is? I can't imagine that this has not been a question from the very beginning. As human beings in general, we have these models about what our world is. So I think Buddhism has this too. And we say, well, we live in the saha world. We live in a world of suffering. In Theravada Buddhism, in the earliest Buddhist teaching, there were these two things called samsara and nirvana. So samsara is suffering, nirvana Sanskrit word means to exhaust or put out the flame of our passions, the flame of our clinging. In this model, if we're trying to attain nirvana, nirvana is someplace different, something, some mindset. It's unclear exactly what nirvana might or might not be. Nirvana is this state or being that one can enter into or experience, except there's no one there to enter in or experience it because we have no inherently existing self. So in that model, the idea is that we get off the wheel of birth and death. We cease to create karma that causes us to be reborn. We get off the wheel of birth and death. And the way this is done is through the activities while we are in birth and death that allow us to enter into this state of mind, state of being, of non-being, beingness called nirvana. It's unclear. In some ways, you can't get there from here. That's not our path statement. That's not what we're doing. So in our school, in Mahayana Buddhism, Nagarjuna said, nirvana and samsara are the same thing. Oh, okay. So that means we're living in this saha world. There's not some other place. There's not some thing, some place that's different from the samsara world. So what that boils down to is that we have to change our relationship to the world. We change our response internally and externally in such a way that we are freed from samsara. We go beyond the concepts of good and bad. So in this way, we have a different relationship to what it is that we're doing. So we are not caught by samsara. That's how we leave samsara. We are not caught by samsara. So that means that, as Dogen says, nirvana is in birth and death. So what can't be anywhere else. We're not trying to leave this world. So I was curious, what exactly does the word saha, this saha world that we live in, this world of samsara, what exactly does that word mean? So our Buddha field, and the Buddha field is, that means that Shakyamuni Buddha had a field that he functioned in, and that field is the saha world. So that's our world. That's the world that we know. In Sanskrit, it's called saha loka. So what is saha loka? So I thought it was really interesting looking at the literal translation of the Sanskrit word. It means two things: the world of endurance, and together with, or conjoined with. So this is the world system of Shakyamuni Buddha. This is our world. I was thinking about that, and I thought, I guess I'm a little literal-minded. I thought, well, is that true? Is there, like, did we make that up? This saha world? Did we make up this model? And, yeah, probably. But it works really well. I think it works really well. And so there are lots of sutras and things that talk about this relationship between the saha world and the Buddha's place in it. And actually, that is a good thing. And I'll return to that. So first, there's this notion that it's the world of endurance. So this is what the Buddha teaches. He teaches about, or Buddhism teaches us about, how it is that we are in this world that's difficult to be in. This world that sometimes feels like we are just enduring. We are just abiding. We are just doing our best to get through our day. We're just doing our best to figure out what in the world is going on. We're doing our best to figure out how to follow the precepts. We're doing our best to follow the practice, to do what is good, to avoid what is evil. That's that world of endurance that we're engaged in. How are we? How can we be in this samsaric world? In the Vimalakirti Sutra, I've told this story lots of times. I really like this story, but this idea endures in other sutras as well. So as you recall in the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti goes and he asks all these bodhisattvas who are in a different Buddha realm. So in Buddhism, we have like billions of Buddha realms, but none of them are like our Buddha realm. All the rest of them are perfect. They're flat. They always are flat. They're flat. I guess you can see for a long way. And in this particular Buddha realm, everyone's enlightened by scent, by fragrance. So all you have to do is smell this fragrance and you're enlightened. So there's not a lot of work involved in this. There's not a lot of enduring happening here. In other Buddha realms, all the trees are made out of jewels. So I guess you just like touch or see one of these jewels and you're immediately, everything's fine, flat, perfect, beautiful. In this way that maybe we think it's perfect. Because these sutras are all written from our point of view, right? Human beings. So maybe we're trying to create this notion of perfection. But actually, we're not made for this world, for that world, are we? I can't imagine how would we be sustained in a world of jewels that was completely flat, no water, no food. But sometimes we try to do that. We think, oh, if I can get enough, right? In some ways, maybe this is about this too. If we can just get enough jewels and riches and status in the world, that we're going to somehow be able to sustain ourselves on that, that's nirvana. And the other thing is, we can't live on smell or odor or air. We need a different kind of sustenance for us. So in the Vimalakirti Sutra, Vimalakirti sends an emissary to this other Buddha field, and all the bodhisattvas who, to my mind, seemed a little immature, they're all like, wow, this is cool. Let's go to the saha world. This looks really great. Let's go check out this Shakyamuni Buddha. And their Buddha, he says, Well, look, don't get arrogant about it. You know, don't be disappointed when you get there because they kind of are doing a different thing than we are. So, of course, they come and they see all the suffering and dirt and hills and, you know, all this stuff. It's a very complicated, messy place, this Saha world. And there's Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, he's there. He's radiating. And the Vimalakirti's there. And there's this huge assembly. And these bodhisattvas are like, what is going on here? These people are like not enlightened. No sense. No perfection here. So as I've told this story before, Vimalakirti, he says in the sutra about this, the bodhisattvas here in the Saha world are also able to labor and be humble. And it is with immeasurable great compassion that they have been born into this Buddha land. The bodhisattvas here are also able to labor and be humble. So this isn't easy. The bodhisattvas in our world are bodhisattvas that endure, that labor, that are humble. In our teachings, we are bodhisattvas. We make this effort to awaken our mind to the Buddha way. We are bodhisattvas. We're not celestial bodhisattvas. We're not radiating light. Although Dogen says, in Uji, he says, you know, the 24 hours of your day are radiant. So maybe we're radiating more than we think we are. So that's the humbleness, perhaps. This way in which we are in this world, and we are humble. And it is with immeasurable great compassion that they have been born in this Buddha land. Bodhisattva doesn't just have to be somebody who's Buddhist. These bodhisattvas are everywhere. In the Lotus Sutra it says, the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, in the Lotus Sutra in chapter 25, he or she just appears in whatever guise is helpful. In one story, Avalokiteshvara is a mangy dog. And anything that you can think of. So the things that we most abhor, perhaps, is a bodhisattva. Perhaps is this emanation of the bodhisattva. So these bodhisattvas, some people we immediately recognize. We say, oh, you know, Martin Luther King was a bodhisattva. Nelson Mandela was a bodhisattva. So all of the people that we see in this world, and the world actually is filled with bodhisattvas of that kind that we can see. Generation after generation of bodhisattvas. People who inspire us. Whether they're people who are just people who are everyday people, or whether they're somebody who's famous. We forget about that, I think, as we get caught in this notion of a Saha world as endurance. We forget about those people and how important it is that they're out there in the world. There's this guy at New Leaf who used to be over a barista over at Pete's. And whenever I see him, he's like so upbeat and happy. And I don't think he's like totally upbeat, happy person all the time. My guess is he probably has quite an edge. But there's something about being with him and his way of being that's just, I go to the supermarket, I'm really glad to see him. You know, it makes me feel great to see him. I think his name is Chris. Sean, thank you. You know exactly what I'm talking about. It's Sean. I see Sean's like, hi, you know, across the store. Glad to see you. And now the other clerk at the store who's not as nice, she's like, oh, I'm glad to see you too. So there's something that he radiates in his everyday bodhisattvaness of being out there in the world that rubs off on everybody, I think, who comes in contact with him. So, and he's no saint. Like I said, I'm sure he's, you know, he strikes me as somebody who's probably got his dark side. But it's real, you know, and it's inspiring. So this world of endurance. So the bodhisattvas here are also able to labor and be humble, and is with immeasurable great compassion that they have been born in this Buddha land. The bodhisattvas of this land are resolute in their compassion for sentient beings here. Resolute in their compassion. If we have a notion that this world is perfect, that our world should be perfect, how can we be resolute? How hard is it to keep our faith in the midst of constantly feeling like it's being knocked down because it's not meeting some notion that we have of what it should be? So part of this is about accepting our world as it is, which is not to say that we shouldn't respond to the world. I'm not suggesting that we become very passive and not responding, but I am saying that this is our world, that all of this practice of all beings changes, has an effect, that we make this effort, that this is our practice, this being resolute in our compassion for sentient beings here. Not sentient beings in our imagination, not sentient beings as they should be, but sentient beings here, right now, all of us in the midst of our mistakes. The people that we disagree with about politics or morals or whatever it is, they are doing their best to make this a better world. Even though you're like going, are you kidding me? How could that be? But they are. They're doing their best, just like we're doing our best. So how can we find a way to talk to each other? I was just listening to Gyokoko Carlson, who's a teacher at Dharma Rain. She and her husband started this ecumenical group with evangelical Christians in Portland. And they've created this really close bond with these communities. And as she said in her lecture that I listened to, which she gave in November, she was talking about how, you know, people have completely opposite notions of what's, how they want to see society than she might have. So there's this way in which everybody can go in and talk to each other, even though they're not in some ways in agreement about how it should be. And yet there's this willingness to go in and respect each other, to be curious about, these are words that she uses, to respect each other, to be curious about each other, to make this connection. It also says in the Vimalakirti Sutra during this section, it says, you know, the reason that we have poverty is so that we can have generosity. So, there's, you know, anger breeds compassion. We might kind of disagree with that logic and say, why do we need poverty in order to have, in order to be able to be generous? But the fact is that in this world of endurance, we do have poverty, we do have anger, we do have all of these kleshas and difficulties. And they do help us to learn how to be compassionate and kind and curious and moral and upright, and how to communicate and how to talk to people that are different than we are. That's what a bodhisattva does. That's what is happening in chapter 25 of the Lotus Sutra. The bodhisattva appears in the guise that they need to appear in so that they can actually have this dialogue in this way. I can't tell you specifically how to do that in every situation, but it does involve this willingness to be curious and open, this willingness to dialogue with somebody. Again, when I say this kind of thing, I'm not saying you shouldn't take action. I'm not saying don't do anything. The other thing is, when we take action, sometimes we make mistakes, sometimes we fail. This is the Saha world too. We have an idea about what we want to see happen, and so we do this thing, and it doesn't work. Okay, the other definition of the Saha Loka is together conjointly. So that brings us to this aspect of everything is about cause and effect. Everything is in relationship with each other. That we're almost like, as Dogen says in Zenki, the whole works, we're kind of like this big machine. The world, reality itself, is kind of like this big machine that's sort of pumping out reality, if you will. And all the parts of the machine are working together to make reality. And so we're a part of that machine. The bell is a part of that machine. The sky is a part of that machine. However you want to think of this, they also refer to it as a tapestry. So it's like a loom, the loom of reality, it says in a koan, the loom of reality, making this tapestry of reality. So this messy tapestry that's being made by all of reality simultaneously, this one big thing that's happening that we're calling the Saha world. So this for me goes to our teaching that we talk about a lot, which is about interconnectedness, interpenetration, compassion with. How do we negotiate that? How do we negotiate that? And to me, I keep coming back to the notion that we have to start with the fact that the world is very messy. I was reading Dogen. When I read Dogen, you know, Dogen's very... poetic, inspiring, confusing, complicated, simple. And here's a man who lived in Kamakura, Japan, which was a very messy time. There was a huge amount of violence going on in his culture. He himself, his mother died, his dad was killed, there was all this personal upheaval. He grew up in a fairly affluent family, which he would have had to have done because he was very well educated, and that wouldn't have happened probably if he was born, you know, to a farmer's son. So he was the son of an aristocrat, but that was a very dangerous world, being an aristocrat in Kamakura, Japan. Very hierarchical, lots of violence, lots of things going on, warring, people fighting with each other all the time. It was also the time when the samurai class became a major influence in Japan. So this is not a guy who didn't know about the messiness of our world. This is not somebody who was sitting up in an ivory tower, you know, pumping out stuff. But in some ways, he always took the high road, the Buddhist high road. He was always talking about how do we do this? How do we first see it? How do we see this connection? How do we see that this world is connected? How do we understand the nature of the working of this loom, the working of this whole works, as he calls it, Zenki? How do we understand what it is to be in birth and death? How do we understand that? How do we use that as a kind of foundational, inspirational practice for us in this Saha world? So, you know, and Dogen says, he says, you know, this enlightenment, this realization, this response can only happen here, not somewhere else, here, right now. So this being in conjunction with this togetherness, as also a definition of samsara, this is about sangha. This is about how we practice together. This is about how we support each other by understanding the teachings together in a certain way. Sort of, we're all playing the same game or field. We're all playing the same rules, by the same rules. And then there are a lot of people who aren't. You know, they have a different model of what they're doing. But we support each other to stay encouraged. We support each other to continue to do this practice as individuals, because that's the other thing. We do the practice as individuals. When I'm out driving my car, I'm doing my practice as an individual. When I'm relating to people, I'm doing my practice as an individual. Nobody else can teach me compassion in the sense of getting me to do it, right? I mean, we have to have the courage and the effort to do this ourselves, and yet simultaneously it is the totality of the whole world that enables us to do it. So it's sort of both, not one, not two. So that too is part of samsara. Dogen writes in a fascicle called Hotsu Mu Joshin, which means arousing the supreme thought of enlightenment. He's quoting a sutra. He said, when a bodhisattva confronting samsara first arouses the thought of enlightenment and earnestly seeks bodhi mind, he or she becomes firm and unshakable. The merits of this one thought are deep, extensive, and boundless. This awakening to the bodhisattva vow to want to be, to want to engage in beneficial action, to want to make the effort to figure out how in the world we do that, to want to take these teachings and so soak our psyche and hearts and bodies with this teaching that we're able to embody it and go out and respond, to go out and try the best we can to be a bodhisattva in the world, to go to the Million Woman March and be a bodhisattva in the midst of that, to go to some other demonstration, to talk to some relative or friend of ours who doesn't agree with us and be a bodhisattva in the midst of that, to be curious, to not throttle them, to try to keep the channels open. Right now we're living in such a polarized time, and I think we're all kind of frightened about it. I don't care what your political, you know, persuasion is. I think people are really scared. Of course, what happens when we get frightened? When we get frightened, we get really rigid. Where we can't be curious when we're scared, because curiosity is a very scary thing when you're already frightened. What you want to do is like build some walls and get behind them and, you know, get your spit wads ready to shoot over to the other person. We also tend to feel like this is the worst time ever. You know, nothing's ever been this bad. And actually, if I look at history, I think, you know, there are many things about this time that are absolutely stellar, are really wonderful. And of course, there's always work to be done. We live in the Saha world. There's always something to be done. So we should always want to be making that effort. We're always making that effort. But at the same time, we have to hold those things together, right? We have to hold that kind of optimism and going forward mindset simultaneously. Not get caught, not get scared. Be able to, with a clearer vision, see what needs to be done, right? To discern what needs to be done. And in our teaching, the way we discern that is by going deeply into the teachings themselves and trying to learn how to embody them. We sit zazen. We give ourselves that space to be able to just be present for what is without thoughts about what that might be, without scaring ourselves about what that might be or feeling that we have to run out and go do something, that we can just sit there for a minute. We can just sit there and be with what is. So it's always good to take a moment and be with what is. So, Dogen said, when a bodhisattva confronting samsara, so when we are waking up to this life that we are in, this first thought of enlightenment, that's first thought, and then earnestly seeking for that, trying to find out what that is, that the more we do that, the more we become firm and unshakable in our faith that this is a wholesome activity. This is an activity worth throwing ourselves into. This is an activity that takes courage. This is an activity that's humbling. This is an activity that's encouraging. This might even be fun. We might even find a way to be joyous. I don't think of Zen in a way as being joyous. Just too bad. But this vivacity, you know, this full engagement in our lives. Then he says about this, he says, you should clearly understand, so this is Dogen's comment on this, he says, you should clearly understand that using samsara to arouse the thought of enlightenment is the same as earnestly seeking Bodhi. So this is this teaching of Dogen's, which is, as soon as we arouse the thought of enlightenment, as soon as we engage in the practice of enlightenment, this is enlightened practice. We're not doing it to get enlightened. That is actually the mind of the Buddha coming forward and expressing itself. A bodhisattva's one thought is identical with the life of a single blade of grass or a tree, because it is one life and one death. This is samsara. This is the other definition of samsara, to be joined with. One thought, this thought, the bodhisattva's thought of seeking the Buddha's mind, is identical with the life of a single blade of grass or a tree, because this is one life and one death. This is just things as they are in this moment. So we have these twin ideas in our nirvana of suffering and altruism, of wanting to end suffering, and also this altruism of the practice that we enact through practice. So this saha world is impermanence, and it's uncertainty, it's pain, and those are all the motivations for ourselves, right? Not just altruistically for all beings, but we are all beings, so we're also trying to end our own suffering as well as the suffering of others. So that's the motivation. That's what our waking up is. That's the bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to enter them. Dharma gates are boundless. I kind of go from the bad to the good. You know, all the suffering, all this delusion. And then Dharma gates are boundless. Everything we do is a Dharma gate. Everything we do has this possibility of the Bodhi mind response. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So this faith that this teaching is helpful, that this teaching can tell us something about how we negotiate this world that we live in, how we can most skillfully be in this world, completely in this world, passionately in this world, and not caught at the same time. So we're not trying to get out of this world. Maybe even a radical thought that we're not trying to change its basic nature. Right? That this basic nature of this saha world is what it is. And how can we best, in the midst of our own foibles and problems and difficulties and failings and shortcomings, how can we most be helpful? How can we be helpful? How can we fall down, as they say in Japanese, you know, fall down 7 times, gets up 8? How can we use the ground of reality to pick ourselves up? Dogen says you use the ground to get up off the ground. So this ground can be reality itself, this teaching of this interconnection, this complete working. We use that to get up off the ground. And it is not different. They are the same thing. And there's also just the notion that when we get up, we need something to push up against in order to get up. That's our support. The ground supports us to stand up. The ground of the teaching, the ground of the bodhisattva mind supports us to stand up. The Buddha Dharma supports us to stand up. The Sangha supports us to stand up. So I'll give you one more quote. This is from the Blue Cliff Record, and it's from The Highest Meaning of the Holy Truths, which is a koan about Bodhidharma coming from the West. But this is the introductory statement of koan. When you see smoke on the other side of the mountain, you already know there's a fire. When you see horns on the other side of a fence, right away, you know there's an ox there. Given one corner, you grasp the other three. one glance and you discern the smallest differences. When you have stopped the diluted activity of consciousness, so not stopped consciousness itself, but actually stopped the mind of delusion, whatever situation you find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom in adversary and prosperity in taking and giving. Now tell me, how, in fact, will this sort of person behave? So here's what I get out of this. And by the way, this quote was brought to mind from a listserv on the Soto Zen Buddhist Association teachers listserv, and people have been talking back and forth about how we should do social action, which is great. So there's sort of been this whole discussion about this on the listserv, and someone put this on the listserv. So when I read this in this context, I say, okay, well, we're concerned about what's happening in our world. We're in the Saha world. We see smoke. And I think we can say, oh, there's probably fire, because that's the causal conditions, right? When we see smoke, usually it's fire. So that means maybe there's a problem. When you see horns on the other side of the fence, right away you know there's an ox there. Now this is an interesting line, because in Buddhism, the ox is about practice, right? The 10 ox herding pictures are about our path, about how we engage, how we understand, how we wake up. The ox can also be, oh, there's a bull in that corral, and maybe I don't want to get in there because it could be dangerous, right? So there's kind of this image here, both of these things. He says, given one corner, so I think the notion here is if you have one corner, you automatically understand the other three. Another translation is, one finger, you know three. So there's this way in which we intuitively understand these connections that are going on. So what to do about that? What to do about seeing smoke and knowing that there's fire? What to do about seeing the horns of the ox and knowing there's an ox in the corral? What to do about holding one corner and knowing the other three? What do we do about that? And so what we do about that is we see that, but we also pay attention to our mind of delusion at the same time. Because that's what our bodhisattva path is about, is paying attention to the mind of delusion. So in this Saha world, we see fire. In this Saha world, we see the bull. In the Saha world, we know, we discern the differences. We know that this is happening. We see that there is a fire. And we want to put out that fire. We want to tame the ox. So how do we best discern how to do that? And that's where the teachings come in and help us to understand how to do that. And that's why he says at the end, when you have stopped the deluded activity of consciousness, then whatever situation you may find yourself in, you enjoy perfect freedom. You're not caught. Or if you are caught, you're caught in a way that it's okay to be caught, because you're not caught by your caught. So this way that we enjoy perfect freedom in the midst of the Saha world, we enjoy perfect freedom. This is that nirvana. In adversity and prosperity, in taking and giving, so all of these things are happening, these dichotomies, adversity, taking and giving, prosperity. So then the last part is, now tell me, how, in fact, will this sort of person behave? And that's our question. How does this person behave? How do we behave? So that's our koan. Go out, do stuff. Go out, speak your mind. Go out, make a difference. Be a rabble rouser. But then the question is, how do we behave? Thank you very much.